Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
We have a great show for you coming up. We're going to, again, just hide the identity of the guest until it's time to tell you who it is. But it's a cool guest.
It's a good
Got a lot of great things to say. For those of you who didn't follow our Monday morning episode, where we review the Sunday news shows, we have a new hero on this show who is a television reporter, a former television reporter by the name of Charles Jaco, who's just really funny. And our intrepid producer, Matt Williams is a baseball player.
Our intrepid producer, not Matt Williams, but Matt Wilson.
Yeah, Matt Williams was a baseball player. Yeah.
Right. He's also my imaginary friend. He's Matt's imaginary friend producer.
Right. Right. Not that person, or the actual person, Matt Wilson. Did a little compilation for us of the greatest hits of Charles Jaco. We just wanted to take a quick look to introduce.
It's our Jaco of the week.
Jaco of the week. This is real quick. This is our new hero we've discovered.
This is a cool clip of a very offended, triggered Tea Party member asking Charles Jaco about, speaking of members, about whether or not he knows what tea bagging means.
Hey, Mr. Jaco, why do you constantly use the sexually derisive term teabagger?
Oh, I didn't know it was.
You didn't know it was, really?
No, I didn't know.
Seriously,
can you tell me what it is?
I would.
Sure.
See, it's if you want to go to Wikipedia, you got a black bear, you never Wikipedia teabagger, ever.
No. Can you tell me what it is?
And you don't know the...
And can you tell me what your interest is?
My interest is that you constantly use it as a way to derive teabaggers, you know, as what you call teabaggers.
Oh, all right.
Why do you do that? You're seriously going to look me in the face and tell me you did not know the negative connotation of teabagger?
That's right.
I told you he was a smoker.
Wow.
Yeah.
Never heard it from Keith Olbermann or...
No.
Rachel
Maddow. No, but I'll tell you what, since you seem to be well-versed in it, can you tell me what it is?
I'm not well-versed in the practice, but I know
it is. You seem to be well-versed in the practice. Can you tell me what it is? Because I have no idea what it is. I just know that they represent radical extremists, but in terms of teabagging, can you tell me what it is?
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to tell you what it is, okay? The negative sexual connotation to teabagging is... the practice of placing one's genitalia on another's face.
Oh, that's vile.
Yes, it is.
How did you know something like that?
Well, it's in Wikipedia and it's a commonly used slang.
How did you know something like that?
It's commonly used slang.
I can't believe somebody so young and fresh-faced would know something so absolutely repulsive.
It is repulsive.
Well, that's creepy.
Don't you think it's repulsive that you use the term all the time? And now that you know what the term means, are you willing to stop using it?
Well, I'll tell you what. Because I'm not sure whoever you are that you're a bunch of a reliable source for anything.
But well, just go check Wikipedia. I mean, it's pretty common.
Wikipedia. How do you spell that?
I think you know.
That's good. That's funny.
I mean, he's kind of graduated and you know, he's just deadpan, right?
Yeah, deadpan. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you pretend not to know something. The guy was really weird, though. Who was that bothering him?
I don't know. It's like what's that right wing gotcha organization?
Oh yeah, Veritas.
Veritas, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's like Veritas Light. Seems like
Veritas Light. Yeah, Verit.
Ver. No, there's kind of a wacky, playful side of him, you know, with that cut we showed the other day of him saying "Je suis un journaliste américain," like that. That's very good. So yeah.
Who came up with even using, like, was that you who found? I know Wilson, you put the thing together, but Matt, was that you who like chose him as to focus on for the fashion?
Yeah, because I was looking for old school reporters who do the hands on hips thing,
right?
And I remembered him because he was like famous for the khaki on khaki look. But then we found those outtakes, which were really, really funny. So anyway, we'll have more about Charles Jaco later. But just to remind people about that period, there was a period there, or about 3 or 4 months, when when a lot of these kind of Tea Party types we're stuck between, should we continue calling ourselves teabaggers, or should we react with outrage to the fact that people are bringing up what it really is? And they kept with it for months.
Yeah, they did. It's kind of brave.
It was brave. I think it was a wrong move.
You think it was the wrong move?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, if they had owned it, if they had the balls, if only they had the balls to stand by it by and saying it. You know, they should have just said they're teabag positive. And by the way, the definition, he's not that tea partier is so stupid. He doesn't even, it's not genitals, it's testes in particular.
Yeah, it has to be testicles.
Yeah.
Yeah. And only testicles.
Testicles and only testicles. By the testicles, for the testicles, and of the testicles.
Right, because if there's anything else involved, then we're talking about something else entirely.
We're doomed.
Right, and you have to have that visual of dunking the tea bag in the tea.
Right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Now I get why you're saying testicles and only testicles. Yes, exactly, yeah.
All right, so let's get to the four food groups.
All right.
Am I up first?
Yeah, you're up, but Dem Suck, yeah.
All right, Dem Suck. So I'm being a little bit disingenuous here because this could have been easily Republicans suck too. Felt like pointing it out that there has been an epidemic of former officials who are going on television and appearing in sort of big time media, opining on the Afghanistan story and being identified by their titles and not by their current occupation. And so one of the worst offenders has been Jay Johnson, who was the Homeland Security Secretary under Obama. You might remember he actually once upon a time played kind of a key role in the Russiagate story, but that's a long, long time ago. He was all over the news about Afghanistan. Let's just look at some of the clips, because what's notable about this is that he went on basically every cable channel and not one of them did the right thing. So Matt, if we could just see each one of those in succession. So here he is with Wolf Blitzer.
I was listening to the prior discussion.
There's his identification, former Secretary of Homeland Security.
People in the Situation Room in the Biden administration, many of whom I serve with in the Obama administration. I remember what it's like 4 or 5 years ago to be in the hot seat, be in the midst of a crisis. It does seem, however, obvious that our government did not anticipate the situation in Kabul at the international airport and the mass exodus that would be attempted. Had we anticipated this, had we seen this coming, we would have, for example, left open Bagram Air Base.
Let's go on to the next one. So remember, he's talking about, we should have left open a base. Here he is on Face the Nation, CBS.
When are we leaving? If not now, when? If I were advising the president, I probably would have recommended that we keep in place in country a highly trained force of about 2,500 or so for counterterrorism purposes. The president, I know, understands the stakes. He's heard it before, 8 years as vice president, and has decided, along with the support of most Americans, apparently, that it is simply time to get out.
So we can move on to the next one. Remember, here he is. He's saying, let's leave 2,500 special forces in country. Here he is on CBS This Morning.
It does seem as though we had to rush to get the 6,000 in. We did not anticipate, and the president acknowledged this, we did not anticipate the speed with which the Afghan government would collapse and
should
the Taliban.
Should he have anticipated it, do you think?
Given it's difficult to second guess. I don't have the intelligence assessments anymore that I used to read every single day when I was secretary.
Yeah.
But it does seem as though, given the timeline we were on, that this Afghan government was going to collapse rapidly because of the way in which we got out and because of their own inability to fight. The whole thing collapsed like a tent on toothpicks.
This is MSNBC.
I like the way he spells his name. J-E-H.
Bring in the former Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama to talk about all this, Jay Johnson. Mr. Secretary, good to see you this morning. Let's start with Afghanistan and the announcement we're expected to hear from President Biden today that before the 20th anniversary of September 11th, almost 20 years since that October day when the first troops set foot in the country, that they'll be coming home, all of them. What's your reaction to that? And what do you think are the implications for the global threat assessment? What does it mean for the threat of terrorism from that part of the world?
Well, the first time I visited Afghanistan, when I was general counsel of the Defense Department in 2009, there were things that struck me. One, it's a mountainous terrain. It is largely ungoverned space, very tribal. And the Taliban basically takes the attitude that we may have the watches, but they have the time. Not much has changed over the last 12 years. They've essentially been waiting us out until we finally leave. We have to be realistic that when that happens, they will likely overrun the country. They will overwhelm the existing government. There will be a huge setback to women's rights. There are not many good solutions. There is no obvious better solution to leaving. Ideally, there should be a three-way agreement between the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the United States, but that's not going to happen.
So Matt, you're I think it's very important to, you know, this is very relevant experience, right? His background, his past, but what is it that they're leaving out that you think is so relevant right now?
Just quickly, he goes on and in one of those to advocate the so-called middle ground plan, which is like, you know, let's not go all the way out, you know, let's do it in stages, whatever. No, Jay Johnson sits on the board of Lockheed Martin now. That's his job.
Oh.
Right. And so this has become, it's incredibly frustrating because this is all over the news media now. And it's not just Jay Johnson. He's one of the worst because he's on TV a lot. You have people like Condoleezza Rice, who's on the board of a company that does AI contracting for the Pentagon. David Petraeus, who's on the board of several defense contractors. You know, there's a series of others. It's gotten to the point where the only place where you see like General Jack Keane is another one. Mark Esper, the former defense secretary, he's another former Raytheon person. Jack Keane is the guy who makes Humvees. There's just a lot of these people. Megan O'Sullivan is a Raytheon board member. She did a story in the Washington Post earlier this year where the headline was, it's wrong to pull troops out of Afghanistan, but we can minimize the damage. And when you look down at the bio, it just said Megan O'Sullivan is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. She was deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't until she took some flack from some like indie reporters that they put in the fact that she's on the board of directors at Raytheon Technologies. So this is a thing that's like buried in news coverage everywhere. Like, you know, Megan O'Sullivan was quoted repeatedly by the New York Times in the last couple of weeks. They didn't bring up the Raytheon thing. It's just something to watch for because a lot of these people, they're not all Democrats, but there's a lot of these people who are kind of in the news lately and they're hiding what their real, affiliations are.
Yeah, it's really disgusting. I mean, it's a joke. It's just such a lack of transparency. You know, it's something that I think Democrats like to pretend Republicans do when it's obviously incredibly bipartisan.
So it's an open question. Like, does the Washington Post, when they do stuff like this, because they've gotten in trouble for a couple of these things in recent years, do they know? You know, when they're doing,
don't they?
Yeah, I think
are they
you have to.
It's dumb or disingenuous? That's it comes down to D or D.
Yeah, I think you have to know. If you don't know that somebody has moved on to a seven-figure salary at, you know, a defense contractor, and that's now what their job is, because you know, if you look at the financial newspapers. Even the financial newspapers are never so shameless as to say like, oh, this person who's pumping up a stock, you know, doesn't work for a hedge fund that's invested in that stock. You know what I mean? Like they would never do that. But you do get that in this kind of stuff, which is kind of amazing. So thought
there's
I'd bring
another
that up.
Conflict of interest, by the way. So
what's that?
Not only is he rejoined after leaving office, he rejoined because he worked for Obama and Trump. He was chosen as the designated survivor and would have become the next president if a disaster attack had occurred. What's that?
Designated survivor? Is there like a new chain of command?
That is so weird. I don't know what that is. But after leaving office in January 2017, he rejoined the law firm, Paul Weiss.
Paul Weiss, yeah. He was
yeah, Paul Weiss. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's Paul Weiss. I didn't realize there were all those other names. Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. He's also a member of the boards of directors of Lockheed Martin, U.S. Steel, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Center for New American Security, WBGO, and a trustee of Columbia University, but also he's on the board of the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. And do you know when his birthday is?
September 11th?
Yeah.
Very nice.
So that's another thing that we have to make sure that we expose.
I mean, what is there anything that's more disgusting than somebody who sits in the spot for doling out billions of contracting dollars and then immediately goes and feeds at the trough of those same companies? Yeah. Like,
there's one thing that's more disgusting, which is doing that without it having it revealed.
Right.
When you are a media expert.
Exactly.
So disgusting.
It
we
is gotta gross.
Do it. How come it's on us? We need to have like, how can we make it? We need to come up with songs or mnemonic devices so everyone knows that these people work or are on the boards of these places.
Yeah, or they should have I mean, this is an old joke, but it's, you know, they should have labels like race car drivers. You know,
yeah,
it says right. STP on your thing. It should say KBR or whatever it is, right? Bechtel,
right?
Because it's ridiculous, and I think it's so shameful that the notoriously ethicsless financial press
is better.
Is way ahead, right. Way ahead of the political press when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, in a way that makes sense though, because they're so like they don't have any kind of pretenses,
right?
In some ways, I mean, I don't want to I'm being a little bit sloppy here, but there's something to the lack of pseudo morality.
It's frustrating because they first started, if you remember an outlet that you write for, Fair, they made a ton of noise about this way back in 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003. In the run-up to both Afghanistan and Iraq, they were constantly pointing out that like affiliations of cable guests were often not disclosed,
right?
And so the you know, the conventional press has had plenty of time to
correct
this issue, and they never do. They never do.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, good friend of the show Sydney Ember, she had a lot of people, as I wrote about for Fair, actually she had a lot of people and who she would cite without you know, providing the relevant information. One, she did update one of them, which was that she had interviewed someone and forgot to say about Bernie Sanders, who like said he was a straight old white man, forgot to say that she was on the Ready for Hillary super PAC, you know, slightly relevant. Anyone who thinks that the New York Times is above that kind of stuff is sorely mistaken. Again, we got to have a DOD of the week, dumb or disingenuous, where we
dumb
like
or disingenuous. Vote. Yeah. No. And you know, Peter Baker, who's the kind of like resident hawk, freaking out hawk reporter for the New York Times, who can't wait to tell you what a mistake it was to move all the troops out of Afghanistan this quickly. Like, you know, he's a serial offender on the score too. So, you know, it's and this is the kind of stuff, again, I hate to keep going back here, but if you want to talk about why the public doesn't trust the news media about things that matter, like getting vaccinated or whatever it is, every time they do one of these little things that is just unnecessary, it just adds.
Oh, so, every time they do something like they do something that where they don't reveal a conflict of interest, a potential conflict.
Yeah,
of interest,
like when they every time they do something that's dishonest or looks like a shilling for you know, the government or whatever it is. You know, we saw what happened with the drone bomb story, which was so classic because this has been going on over and over again, you know, for the last 20 years. The Defense Department put out this very sneakily worded statement afterwards where it said something like, we're not aware of any civilian casualties. That immediately became, you know, no civilian casualties were reported in the press. And of course, you know, within a day or two, the New York Times reporter did his job and he went and he hunted down the people who got killed. You know, it was like a normal family. That you know, there was a guy who was driving up to his house in his Toyota Corolla, and his kids ran out to come see him, and the Corolla gets blown up by a Hellfire missile or whatever it is, and everybody dies. And you know, that's the story. But of course, we run with the bullshit DOD version first. You know, you'd think we'd learn our lesson by now, since they've lied so repeatedly about all this stuff. Anyway, just a thought. So what do we have for Republicans suck?
So yeah, Republicans suck. We got it's like choosing between your children. It's hard to have favorites. So I had two favorites. That didn't really work, that metaphor. Anyway, two stories coming out from guess what state? If it's bad Republican news,
I feel like Texas, Florida.
Texas, you got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Texas. Okay, so there are two stories about coming out of Texas. One, do you want to go with the abortion one first, or do you want to go with the voting one first? Which one do you want to start with?
Let's go for abortion.
All right, let's go for abortion, because they're certainly not. So, Texas enacts near total ban on abortions, the most draconian anti-choice law in the country. I'm reading it, Democracy Now! In Texas, a near total ban on abortions went into effect today at midnight after the U.S. Supreme Court failed to rule on an emergency petition filed by abortion providers seeking to block the measure. So this law bars abortions just 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And that, by the way, is before people will sometimes know that they're pregnant. No exceptions for rape or incest. And this is like this probably one of the worst parts of it. Anyone in Texas can sue patients, medical workers, or even a patient's family or friends who, quote unquote, aid and abet an abortion. Which again, it's not a crime. So it's kind of weird, because how can you aid and abet something that's not a crime? But I guess it is now. And until now, no other 6 week abortion ban has been allowed to go into effect. Yeah, it's really awful. I don't know what's going to happen next. I think that they're going to, people say, reproductive justice advocates have vowed to keep fighting.
Isn't that unconstitutional? Like, I would think that there would be a legal challenge that would be instantaneous.
Yeah, there must, right? Because it's basically undoing Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. No, it's an end run around it for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So what's the other one?
Okay. So then we also have in the same lovely state, we have Texas, the Republican-controlled Texas legislature passes bill overhauling the state's elections. And here's some of the things that it does. It's really great. One of like the most draconian things happens. It aims at Harris County in particular, which is like a growing Democratic hub, and it includes Houston. And here's some of the things that it forbids. Ready? Balloting mm-hmm. methods that the county introduced last year to make voting easier during the pandemic, including drive-through polling places and 24-hour voting, as well as temporary voting locations. It bars election officials from sending voters unsolicited absentee ballot applications and from promoting the use of vote by mail. And apparently, I'm reading at the Times, it greatly empowers partisan poll watchers, creates new criminal and civil penalties for poll workers, and erects new barriers for those looking to help voters who need assistance, such as with translations. And it requires large Texas counties where Democrats perform better to provide live streaming video at ballot counting locations.
Wow.
So, I mean, I don't know what's going to be easier to do moving forward, have an abortion or vote. But I suggest that while you can, do both. While you're waiting online, try to get an abortion. While you're waiting to vote.
I wonder how often, I mean, that's probably not something that people do to get simultaneously a whole lot.
No, but, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, so.
That's true. That's true. That's absolutely right. Yeah, those are pretty bad.
Or at least do them back to back.
Right.
While you still can. Although I guess you can't already. Well, yeah. You really want to act fast, fam. Act fast.
Yeah, definitely.
5 weeks. Don't even wait till the fifth. Try to do it in the fourth. I mean, I'm being somewhat facetious because obviously people may not even know. But yeah.
Eventually, you're only going to be able to vote in your first trimester or something like that.
First trimester, if only.
Right.
That would make it easier. They might as well link those two things, the right to vote and the right to abort.
Right.
You don't want to have to keep track of those two dates. It gets confusing.
It does get confusing, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely.
Abort early and often and vote early and often.
What's your take on, I don't know, I guess we talked about this a little bit on Monday, but the Republicans have been kind of schizoid on the whole Afghanistan thing. Like they can't seem to decide whether they want to take credit for the withdrawal or whether they want to go back in.
Baby with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Birth analogy.
That's right. Throw. Yeah. Let's not even go there to the jokes that are possible in that one, right? So yeah.
But it's really terrible. In case my being glib about it confuses anyone, that's really bad, and I hate Abbott.
He's not good.
He's not good. I think he and Ron DeSantis should be on a desert island together.
I hate DeSantis a little less.
Yeah, maybe. He is a shit-eating grin, Abbott.
It's just
is terrible.
It's not that I like him. I just think that some of the press about him has been a little bit.
What is he doing now? They're like punishing schools that have mask mandates.
Yeah, no, that's fucked up. Well, so, yeah. And this is an issue that's starting to drive me nuts because it gets to the schizophrenia of, frankly, both parties about the exercise of government authority. Like, so the people who are states' rights people, you know, theoretically they're federalists, right? And they loathe federal executive power. They're really, really not into the idea of, you know, the kind of the libs in Washington telling them what to do, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, when there's a state level executive who issues a decree that's kind of dictatorial, and counties or towns want regional control, suddenly they're against that because they're not in favor of that kind of federalist model, right? I mean, that's not really federalism, but it's, you know, it's the same kind of idea. Like, we want more localized democracy when it's at the state level, but we want less of it when we have a governor who's issuing these decrees. And frankly, there's flip-flopping that goes on with the Democrats on that kind of thinking too. There are people who are, you know, completely against any states' rights arguments until suddenly there's, you know, a state by state effort to, you know, start changing, for instance, marijuana laws or something like that, right? But the Republicans are worse about this.
Giving people freedoms, like to be fair, giving people freedom state to state is different. I feel like there's some consistency when you're doing state by state healthcare because it's like they want it to be federal, but it can't be. So it's still not their choice. It's not their lawmaking of choice. You know, I'm not someone who usually really goes out of my way to defend Democrats as consistent. I do think in this case, though, that there's more hypocrisy on the other side.
There is, but there's some. Yeah. There is definitely some on the other side. Like, yeah. I've always been kind of in favor of, like, when it comes to drug laws, for instance, that states should have, that should be a state by state thing. Like, states should be able to, they should be allowed to vote to decriminalize drugs.
Right.
And if you are going to allow that, then it's pretty hard to argue that some other things that Republicans want, you know, as states' rights issues.
But in this case, it's like there's a federal right, like abortion is protected federally. It's like chipping away at rights versus creating more rights. There's something different directionally.
Yeah, I'm not so sure.
All right, we'll have to get some philosophers and law professors. Yeah,
we'll have Samuel Moyne in there.
Exactly. We've got to have him on to talk about his book, Humane, which is totally on topic. It's about how Obama made war more sustainable.
Right. Okay, so four. Isn't that weird? This is a good one. And this is thanks to you. It says raw. This is a New York Post story.
You'll like this one, I think.
Matt, could you just show the video on this?
This is so disgusting. Okay, so what do we got here? We got a, what are these things called then?
Yeah. What the cluck? See, again. Cluck,
yeah. What are these things called? I can't remember what these things are called. Baggage carousel. We got a baggage carousel. So try not losing your lunch, it says. And after seeing this on the baggage claim carousel, and it's, how would you describe it?
It's a big square piece of chicken parts.
Yeah, it's a bunch of chicken parts that fell, that are in a square that must have fallen out of a container.
Ew, luggage filled with raw chicken spilled onto the baggage claim carousel at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, aka SeaTac, adding to the stomach-turning sight the dozen or so chickens had formed into a frozen cube inside the cooler during the flight. So I grew up reading these books by the Wallachinsky family. Ever heard of them?
Mm-mm. Who are they?
They wrote these. They're Canadians, I think. And they wrote these books called the Book of Lists. They also wrote The People's Almanac.
Okay, cool.
Remember that book?
It sounds progressive, but I don't know if I do remember.
No, it's not. It's not. It's just
it's
full
not
of like
people's history.
Yeah, it's like full of just random information.
Yeah.
And they always had a feature in one of them, like 10 things that fell from the sky. So this isn't from the Book of Lists, but it's like sort of the same idea of like stuff that comes out of an airplane. So here's one list. Poultry fell over Virginia last year. Then there was fish fell over the remote Australian town of Lajamanu in 2010.
Oh, so these like literally just dropped from, this wasn't about a conveyor.
Wasn't about a conveyor belt. It's just stuff that came off an airplane and fell onto into the world, right?
Right.
So we've had blood fall out of planes. Frogs, although that's more likely a natural phenomenon, frogs and tadpoles.
I think I forgot about tadpoles.
Sharks have fallen from the sky.
That is the worst. Were the sharks alive or dead?
No, I think they were alive. Spiders, mud, and of course,
very biblical.
Frozen urine is another thing that happens because when you know you're in a plane, you're in a plane. Yeah, exactly. And the waste comes out, but it freezes on the way down. So it like, you know, which is like really gross. So planes.
Like stalagmites or stalactites of piss.
Yeah. There's like gross stuff that comes out of planes, but this is a pretty good, like a cube of defrosting chicken is pretty bad.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder how long it was out there. Like, it's almost like, is that like a grill? If you have something on a conveyor belt, like how long would it have to be on the conveyor belt before it's a nice temperature?
Probably a while. It'd have to be a different kind of conveyor belt too.
When I was younger, by the way, I thought that conveyor belts went all the way from one place to the other, like instead of on the plane. So I thought like if you flew from, you know, to Hawaii, the conveyor belt went all the way to Hawaii.
You really thought that?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm really not that good at stuff like that. I mean, I was a little kid.
Right.
I also thought it took a really long time to develop camera footage because my parents would take forever to remember to bring it in and pick it up. So I thought it was like a multi-year process.
Wow. Wow.
And for kids watching the show, that's when there used to actually be film and you get it developed.
Yeah, they don't know what that is.
Yeah, they don't know what that is. Yeah.
All right. So what do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
Okay. So for Isn't That Terrible and, you know, this is a hard one to talk about. I think, honestly, I shouldn't even set it up. I think we should just go to the video.
RCMP have released a new photo of a man who took an anti-mask protest a step too far. He was refused service at the Dairy Queen in Port Alberni and so began urinating on the front counter of the restaurant. CTV's Gord Kerbis has the latest on the incident that has made headlines around the world.
It's the anti-mask statement that is focusing an unfortunate spotlight on the city of Port Alberni.
Not much you can do about stupidity.
Because I've worked a lot of retail jobs, so it's like I've seen a lot of stupid, crazy stuff that people do.
A man who entered this Dairy Queen on Saturday night was refused service because he wouldn't wear a mask. He took out his frustrations and began urinating on the counter.
What? Oh my God. No, I didn't hear about that.
I don't think it's that difficult to wear a mask.
So here he is. So can we pause this for a second, Wilson? So this is a guy, he's at the Dairy Queen. He's saying, "You do not have a brain," and a very thick Canadian accent. And the staff says, "We can't sell you without a mask." And he goes, "Why?" Okay, keep complaining, please.
Graham Hughes posted the man's antics after his roommate caught them on
and
video.
She says, it's not a BC policy. So he's saying it's not a BC policy, British Columbia. It's you have to protect the exemptions. Okay.
That's taking place in our community, the polarization of opinions and the entitlement, I guess, in a sense of reaction.
The DQP incident is now getting international attention.
We ended up in Newsweek. It ended up with the Huffington Post, Canada, and the American version of it.
Although he doesn't support the method of personal protest, Hughes wants the public to consider what the man may be going through in his personal life.
People who often make these kind of stories of their extreme behavior do have experiences of mental health issues. They do have, you know, substance use issues, or they have, like, you know, they live in a paranoid state.
CTV reached out to Dairy Queen for a comment, but is yet to receive a reply. Meanwhile, RCMP have released a photograph of the man they're looking for.
It's not something that happens very often, and it was a pretty dramatic statement by this individual. And of course, it's still a whodunit, as we're still trying to track him down.
Police say charges may vary, but at this point, they are undertaking an investigation of it being an indecent act. Gord Kerbis, CTV News, Port Alberni.
So, I mean, I'm really tired of this victimhood thing. Put on a fucking mask. I'm sorry.
Or don't urinate.
Well, obviously, okay, then we didn't even get to the urination thing, but that is, like, really disgusting. This guy's a dick. No pun, I really was. He just is. Like, you're such a baby. You're such a baby. You have to piss in front of people on their fucking counter? Sorry, this is, I mean, it's just... And I really do. I am tired of it.
He could be mentally ill.
Okay, if he's mentally ill, he gets a pass. And I love how Canadians are so sensitive. The guy's like, oh, yeah, he's going through stuff. He could be going through mental challenges. And
that's a good Canadian accent.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. There are a couple of different ones.
Who's your favorite? Who's your favorite hockey player?
I think John Candy.
John Candy.
Oh, sorry. Just Canadian actor, not Hollywood hockey player. Wayne Gretzky.
Wayne Gretzky, okay.
Is he Canadian?
He's Canadian,
like the literally, I don't think I know of a single other hockey player, though, so.
Okay, well, that's good. That was a good guess.
Yeah. Who's yours?
What? Probably Bobby Orr. I'm from Boston, but right. another Canadian.
Yeah. Oh, he's on a Boston team, though?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I thought I definitely thought you were going to ask me, and I feel like I can't believe you didn't, like how much money I would need to eat that chicken, by the way. Sorry, I'm going back to the, isn't that
Oh, weird? Yeah. How much money would you need to eat that chicken?
I don't know, but now I want to know how much money would you need to eat? I guess it actually doesn't matter at all. If there's a barrier, a Dairy Queen, like a Frosty, that the man had urinated near.
How much would I need to eat at that Dairy Queen?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not going to lie. I would just pay normal for it. I would just pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. I think I would too. Yeah.
There's a, I mean, it would be different if there was like an opening.
Right.
There wasn't that divider.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But that's like a combo of exposing yourself, vandalism, mask stuff. What's his exemption also?
I don't know. He's vaccinated. I don't know.
I mean, I get it. Masks are really unpleasant to wear, but I definitely wear them.
I wear them too. Yeah. I mean, and especially now with the numbers going back up, I'm kind of basically going to go back into lockdown soon. But there is something about like the edge that people are starting to bring to these disagreements that's gotten a little weird. Like people are hyper emotional about.
Yeah, these are Canadians we're talking about.
Right.
That's
how exactly.
I mean, we're talking about like BC. This is like British Columbia Canadians. Not Quebecois who are always crazy.
Yeah, you can go to a table full of Canadians and just start whacking them with cattle prods and they'll apologize to you.
Yeah, exactly. That's right? How far we've come.
Yeah. And now even they're acting like getting belligerent.
Getting belligerent, yeah.
We have to keep Canadians the way they were.
We have to keep them out of this country.
Well, that's true.
I thought you were going to say, except for Aaron Maté.
Except for Aaron. Well, no, I
David Frum, I want to throw him back out there.
There's been a lot of really good Canadian comedians who've come down here.
We'll let them stay. So who are the top five Canadians we want to send back? David Frum.
David Frum is a good one. All the ones that I'm thinking are ones that I like.
I know. Maybe we're more pro. I mean,
I'm pretty pro Canada.
I'm pro Canada. Oh, my thing with Canada is that they don't get enough credit for being racist.
Right. You mentioned that.
It bothers me. They're terrible.
Just
because you're not the United
that.
States doesn't mean. Don't get a big head, Canada.
No, if Canadians are turning bad like zombies and 28 days later, like that means the disease has progressed too far.
Plus they have healthcare, so that guy should really be taken care of.
probably there's places to pee in Canada too that, you know, aren't counters of fast food places.
Right. And if you're going to do that, at least be masked. Have yes. one thing out, expose one part at a time. Have the decency. I mean, you don't have the decency. I didn't even think of that pun, but yeah.
Yes, I'll co-sign that too. Okay, that was the four food groups. We have a really interesting guest, Kit Kitty. Do you want to tell our listeners?
Really excited to be talking to Spencer Ackerman. Spencer Ackerman, he's the author of a new book called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. He also has a really cool Substack called foreverwars.substack.com. He focuses on the war on terror, and he's been a national security correspondent for outlets like The New Republic, Wired, The Guardian, and currently The Daily Beast. He's reported from the front lines of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo Bay. He shared in the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism for Edward Snowden's NSA leaks to The Guardian, a series of stories that also yielded him other awards, including the Scripps Howard Foundation's 2014 Roy W. Howard Award for Public Service Reporting and the 2013 IRE Medal for Investigative Reporting. Ackerman's Wired series on Islamophobic counterterrorism training at the FBI won the 2012 Online National Magazine Award for Reporting. He wow. frequently appears on MSNBC, CNN, and other news networks. Has an impressive mustache at the moment. And nice. I happen to know him from way back. Guess nice. From where? Guess where I know him from?
Dalton?
No.
Socialist summer camp?
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And so I have some interesting stories I'm going to share, but yeah.
Very good. All right. Well, let's talk to Spencer and get some embarrassing insider details.
So Spencer, welcome to the show. Can you tell people what the thesis, for those who haven't read it, what the thesis of your book is?
Yes. So the book is about
Reign of Terror, by the way.
Reign of Terror. Yeah. How? I mean, the thesis is in the title, but, you know, just to expand on it a little bit.
Sure. So the thesis of Reign of Terror, how 9/11 destabilized America and produced Trump, the 9/11 era, the response America chooses in response to the 9/11 attacks is a doorway to the most violent, most nativist, and the most dangerous currents in American history that are unleashed and given new license after 9/11 to take power and to do so under an atmosphere of righteous patriotic vengeance. I call it the subtext or the engine of the war on terror. Once political elites decide after 9/11 to divorce an interpretation of what prompted the attack from any of the historical and material circumstances that bin Laden outlines in his various communiques before the attack, what remains is a civilizational and metaphysical interpretation of what happened on 9/11, which is to say that, as Bush puts it, evildoers from a marauding foreign civilization are truly the ones that are responsible for this act, not 19 people and the billionaire that they answered to. Accordingly, that filters the direction of America's war on terror down particular paths, all of which favor authoritarian opportunities, the erosion and outright, in some cases, destruction of constitutional freedoms, the things that are supposed to sort of institutionally safeguard both your freedom and your safety, become just decimated by explicit act of the war on terror. So for instance, surveillance, suspicionless surveillance on a scale that would have been unthinkable, as well technologically impossible a generation before, becomes over time not just a persistent force in American national security, but symbiotic with the 21st century capitalist economy, what Shoshana Zuboff of Harvard Business School calls surveillance capitalism. The NSA at this point just piggybacks off of that for a lot of its operations. That's an outgrowth of the war on terror. The steady erosion of the rule of law through processes like that that render the Fourth Amendment quaint, the ability to once defining an ever-shifting enemy in civilizational terms, not only can you invade and bomb and occupy a tremendous number of countries overseas, but also you can use that same justifications against your Muslim neighbors and do things that are unthinkable in other, in things that are unthinkable in white communities, in Christian communities, like creating a network of 10,000, it was estimated in 2010, informants to do things like invade and spy on places of worship. The FBI teaches its counterterrorism agents at one point in the war on terror in a series of stories that I did for Wired that Islam itself is the enemy rather than Al-Qaeda or any other specific terror group. Things like that just compound and compound and compound. And eventually they mix with another very volatile element, which is that the wars themselves in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere are disasters. They don't deliver the kind of dopamine hit for American exceptionalism that they promise after 9/11. They deliver only agony, they deliver only misery. And over time, this creates a real cognitive dissonance in a lot of the people, particularly on the right, whose like real anger and trauma over 9/11 is cultivated by their political leaders into this civilizational context. And they start asking things like, why can't the elites that launched these wars bring them to successful conclusions? And they start rejecting the euphemisms of the whole enterprise, like calling it a war on terror, saying that an Islamic cultural center near, in an Islamic cultural center in lower Manhattan is a ground zero mosque.
Right.
Like it was Mehmet the Conqueror turning Hagia Sophia in Constantinople into a mosque. Those explanations become increasingly desirous, especially after ISIS happens, ISIS, which would of course not exist if not for the invasion and occupation of Iraq, to the point where its refugee flows, people trying to escape ISIS are treated in the United States as an adjunct of ISIS, no different than ISIS. We're seeing that right now in how the Trumpist elements of the right are reacting to the withdrawal from Afghanistan and treating people in this case who served the United States' war interests as being indistinct from the Taliban. This was a slow process from both institutional, political, and cultural lines that basically create such an atmosphere of authoritarian possibility, nativist opportunity, and repressive potential that it makes someone like a Trump figure feel in retrospect inevitable, like he's a lagging indicator of the 9/11 era. Even when he uses very cannily rhetoric that suggests right. He wants to depart from it.
Yeah, you mentioned how he talks about stupid wars, but actually, you know, like civilian killings went up. I think you cite a study that says 330% because of of his role in Afghanistan and, of course, Somalia.
Yeah, you talked in the book about how, I forget the exact wording, but it was essentially that Trump was one of the only candidates who had the insight that the subtext of all these wars was actually this civilizational racist idea about sort of non-white contagion, and that he made that more overt in the way he talked about these wars. But he also took advantage of the other thing that you just mentioned, which was that the wars were failures. Like in his stump speeches, you know, he talked about the stupid wars. He talked about forever wars. I remember him scanning crowds and looking for vets, you know, in the crowds and, you know, adjusting his speeches accordingly to talk about the mistreatment of soldiers and that sort of thing. But the premise of the book essentially is that the United States security apparatus and the way they handled their response to 9/11 created the political conditions for somebody like Trump to take advantage. Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, and the elites in both parties,
that, at least, right.
Both are the architects and the custodians of these wars, particularly as they become like increasing disasters. And it will be those elites who by 2015, 2016, are like, oh my God, where did this guy come from? Like, how could it be? After, you know, take someone like Michael Hayden, who's one of my favorite examples here.
Yeah,
Michael,
you have a lot of great stuff in him about in there about him, by the way.
Yeah, so like Mike Hayden is the architect of bulk surveillance in the United States, just straight up a constitutional vandal, decides on his own in secret to reset the balance for everyone else of liberty and security, then goes on, really an amazing career, to run the CIA and preside over the terminal stages of the black site torture
programs. Yeah,
a guy who lies so relentlessly that there is, in the 2014 Senate torture report, a separate annex devoted just to debunking all of the lies that Hayden tells the Senate, his Senate overseers, in one day of testimony. It's an entire appendix of lies. You've never seen anything like this in a government report about an intelligence official or anyone with like birds or stars on their shoulders. And it's Hayden who, like, throughout the Trump years, not only becomes a hashtag resistance hero, but gives speeches and writes books about like the assault on truth and how, yeah, like he says this in an MIT speech, like he's worried that the bonds of veracity no longer constrain our public discourse and no longer order our minds. And accordingly, how can a free, you know, republic persist? And it's just like, and like that's interesting question. Like, who might it better be aimed at? So you get these circumstances where the people who are most against Trump are the people who have seeded the ground for him and kind of want to return to like the status quo ante, like two steps back from Trump, not recognizing that they are generating like more and more Trumps, and that like just as a like a matter of political faction, like, you're the guy the bear is going to eat first because you're closest. And I think like that's the story a lot of the contemporary Republican Party.
How big of a political mistake do you think it was to, I mean, look, Michael Hayden's he's a paid analyst on CNN, as you know, as are half of the people profiled in your book as being the most catastrophic decision makers throughout this time period. We saw the whole bunch of them revived in the last couple of weeks. People who had direct responsibility for a lot of the things that went wrong in Afghanistan, and yet they're still upheld as trusted, revered authorities by the kind of Washington press consensus. Doesn't that only help a Trump, you know, that he can point and say, you know, look at those people, like they, you know, these are the elites who've been lying to you, and they're still on TV and doing all that stuff?
Yeah, we saw it happen the first time that Trump ran for president. He like the people who were most fervently against Trump had, without recognizing it, maneuvered themselves into like such a disadvantageous position by virtue of what they had done over the previous 15 years that Trump can always point to that and say that you never need to listen to these people again because they have walked you into a disaster that only I can fix, that only through the application of unapologetic civilizational violence can we redeem something from this nightmare. And like, we'll occasionally use, you know, like he used to talk about like 22 daily veteran suicides as a way of wrapping himself in the flag and trying to, you know, maneuver war on terror politics in a direction where he could more successfully wield them than a lot of his political opposition. And also remember that like his most important security validator is Michael Flynn, who more than nearly anyone on earth can personally say that he waged the war on terror like at its most like grim and violent. You know, Flynn takes away from that service two really like central points that fit perfectly inside the both Trumpist narrative and the coalition that they're building in the agenda that it's going to serve, which is that first, the enemy is Islam. And second, the enemy is also the people within the security state that don't allow me to say and act like the enemy is Islam. The people who would restrain me in my violent and carceral action on the basis of some pathetic, decadent fantasy that you can have a more antiseptic war, a war that like now needs to respect the people that it in fact is aimed against. Flynn like is in this kind of crisis of American exceptionalism that occurs when he's pinioned between the wars that he's fought that are supposed to be these, you know, valorous reassertions of American power determining how the world will once again work in America's favor, and the realities of how nightmarish and disastrous and wasteful all of it in fact, you know, turns out to be. And then of course, when Flynn is the subject of the Mueller investigation, that becomes this perfect opportunity to use like the rampant criminality and corruption of the Trump clique as a way of saying those same people who are persecuting Mike Flynn are the same people that have gotten us into this wretched circumstance. And by the persecution of Mike Flynn and through him, Donald Trump, this witch hunt that is happening is ultimately a way of performing a coup against the 2016 election. And all of that tacitly justifies, as Mike Flynn will do the day before the Capitol insurrection, trying to launch a coup to overturn the 2020 election. And I would just suggest, as I do, as is kind of a theme of the book, that the longer this war on terror circumstance goes on, the more and more it's going to be indistinguishable from domestic American politics, and the more the tools of the war on terror are going to be used against Americans, whether it was what we saw in the summer of 2020, where the Department of Homeland Security is putting protesters in Portland into unmarked vans, launching surveillance by drone over 15 cities, using the Joint Terrorism Task Forces against anti-fascist protesters, and so on. And now, after January 6th, where the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress aren't really interested in challenging the political figures that called and spread the lie about the 2020 election being stolen and prompted and directed January 6th. Instead, they're using only a security approach, prosecuting low-level people who like committed acts of violence or at least acts of criminality that were already illegal in the insurrection, but having no other answer than to kind of throttle how far they want to reorient the mechanisms of war on terror, law enforcement, and surveillance against this, which of course reaffirms the narrative of the extreme right.
Yeah, I mean, I get that there's a need to adequately prosecute all that, but the expanding and creating a domestic war on terror, which is the language that's being used, right? It just continues this 20-year process of blurring the lines between, you know, an essentially lawless surveillance state that's been aimed both abroad and at home, and you know the kind of undeclared wars that we've been conducting all around the globe. To conservatives, what it looks like is we're just doing this at home now. We're going to have warrantless surveillance of everybody, and obviously there's a real threat there, but they do have a little bit of a point, don't they? That we're treating this almost like, you know, a domestic version of the war on terror, aren't we?
No, that's what I'm saying. That now that the Biden administration like views as both normal and responsible to filter his response to January 6th along law enforcement, intelligence, you know, general security line, we should have realized, we should have learned like a central lesson of the war on terror, which is that securitizing responses to political challenges is a disaster foretold, and it only makes people less safe and less free and more vengeful. And add to that tinderbox the fact that the tools of the war on terror are not getting broken. Trump certainly didn't break any of them. He wanted to wield them. Biden isn't breaking any of them right now, despite pulling out from Afghanistan, which I believe is obviously the right thing to do. And so once this dynamic entrenches itself further, war on terror responses to your domestic political opponents will become more and more normalized, and consider what that might mean. First, like we know from one of the, this is one of the reasons like I start my book in Oklahoma City and not with 9/11, like the actual track record of the law enforcement and intelligence agencies prosecuting, you know, white terror is very, very bad. More typically, they use the mechanisms and the powers allowed to them, supposedly for purposes like that, against left-wingers and non-white people. We should expect to see that because we already saw that in the summer of 2020. But beyond that, thanks to the Obama administration, a future right-wing presidency, or even the Biden administration currently, who knows, but has opinions of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel that say, if you consider someone, even an American citizen, deeply dangerous, and like one of the law enforcement or intelligence agencies says it's too dangerous or impractical to apprehend them, you can just execute them without trial. That's what happened to someone named Anwar Awlaki. And ultimately Samir Khan and Awlaki's son, Abdul Rahman, who was only 16 years old. That is, I think, like a really serious Chekhov's gun. Like, we should not think that as long as these mechanisms and quasi-legal but truly illegal, nevertheless institutionalized rationales and apparatus of justification for this persist, that's not going to be the last drone strike against an American citizen. And if that prospect frightens you, as I think it ought to, then that becomes an argument, even if all the other arguments fail, the solidaristic arguments for why, you know, we have to stop a war that's now killed 900,000 people, immiserated so many, displaced at least 22 million people, looted $8 trillion, according to a study that came out by the Cost of War Project at Brown University the day we're recording this. Even if none of that is compelling to you, the prospect of a drone killing someone that you know, perhaps you ought to consider that as like an urgent argument for abolition of this entire enterprise.
Yeah, I covered a couple of years ago a court case. It was a lawsuit by an American citizen named Bilal Abdul Karim, who sued the United States government because he believed that he had been the target of a series of drone strikes. He was a cameraman. He's a who has some jihadist leanings, but whatever. That's not the point.
Dabbled.
He sued, and the United States government in a courtroom was arguing that it had the right to use lethal force without trial. And there were no other reporters in the courtroom. And I remember thinking to myself, this is kind of a big deal for the federal government to be openly saying that, asserting that it has the right to do this. And, you know, why does nobody care? Because I imagine the public does care on some level, right? I mean,
they would if they knew.
Or is that not true? Did they not care? I mean, that's an interesting.
This was under Trump or Obama? Sorry.
This was under Trump, but the act happened under Obama. But the point is, I think a lot of what you're talking about these, the tools of the war on terror, over the course of the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a lot of suspicion that's been generated on both the left and the right towards the government because they've done a lot of the sort of unilateral extra legal things that people don't like and frighten people.
And encased in an apparatus of lies to both justify it, claim that it's not as bad as it was, and hide the truth from the public about it. Beyond the apparatus of lies is an apparatus of secrecy, where most of the war on terror in its operational form still resides. We haven't remotely seen most of what the war on terror in fact is. This happens so overwhelmingly out of sight. And then on top of that is an atmosphere from political, journalistic, and intellectual classes of justification, of normalization, of reckoning this as the unfortunate costs that are still necessary in a dangerous world if you don't want another 9/11 to happen. You know, think about how rarely the stories of the people who were on the receiving end of the war on terror have been told over the last 20 years. Think about how readily you've heard, and you know, are going to hear again in this wave of commemorative coverage for the 20th anniversary that's about to happen, that America after 9/11 was united together.
Yeah.
I recently had occasion for some reporting that I'm going to be doing of my own like commemorative, you know, 9/11 retrospective for my Substack newsletter, Forever Wars, to look at accounts from children near where I live in Brooklyn had at the time of the response to 9/11, a time when many of their parents were getting cards swept under their doors from FBI and INS agents saying, call us, we need to talk, where they would tell community leaders how at school they would be called Osama, they would be told to go back where they came from, that they would get their ass kicked as vengeance for 9/11, that they were going to get, and this is something that came up again and again, threatened with being informed on to immigration authorities or the NYPD or the FBI or something like that. And a lot of them as well wrote in a section where they were in, like asked, like, what action did you take in response? They were like, I wouldn't tell my teacher, I wouldn't tell anyone around me except like my parents because of how afraid they were. Like this, you know, it's, that was what the unity after 9/11 really concealed, who it was aimed against. And those are just, you know, some measures among many.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. That was great.
It was great. Yeah. Those pictures weren't embarrassing.
I thought you would laugh more at them. I mean, no, they weren't embarrassing, partly because he looks the exact same, I realize. So, like,
he doesn't. I could barely identify.
Oh, you don't think so?
No, I couldn't identify him at all.
I guess he's gone through puberty, so that's a difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's kind of pubescent in those, but they were cute.
Yeah. Were you in any of those photos?
No. He was a year ahead of me. So there could be some photos with us, but that, like, the camp, actually, depending on when that was, I could have been on that same trip. I have to find out from my friend who took them what years those were from.
Hmm. Look, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, the book's thesis is really interesting. I didn't agree with everything in it,
yeah,
but I think as a chronicle of all the stuff that's gone wrong during that time period, it's incredibly valuable because, among other things, because most of the books written about the war on terror have been written from the other point of view. You know, we really haven't looked at the war from the concept, from the point of view of, this was a disaster from the start that could have been averted by employing some other policy that didn't involve just randomly striking out at somebody because we were pissed. It's really great and it walking us through all those bad decisions, all the bad political decisions, everything that happened during the Obama years that kind of politically nudged us towards Trump. He's very laser focused on, you know, a question we just don't talk about a whole lot, which is, What is the political and psychological subtext of this entire gigantic enterprise, which nobody ever, we don't talk about it. We're in war all over the place. And everybody seems to think that it's all interconnected because they're all jihadists or something like that. But these are different groups. It's different situations. Some of them are not terrorist groups. Some of them are internal civil wars. We're just all over the place, having military operations that are doing different things, and we never really think about why that is. I mean, like, if you remember the 80s, it was like a huge deal. We went to Grenada for 2 days.
I felt so much safer.
Right? Like, they made a Clint Eastwood movie about that. And we, you know, today that wouldn't, it would not make the news unless something remarkable happened, like a Kardashian landed there by mistake, you know? Right.
Yeah, did you see Ian Milhouse, is that his name? Who tweeted, like, today, this is the first day of my life, America's not at war or something?
No.
People have to remember, we're still at war. We're still in a bunch of wars.
Yeah, no, we're all over the place. Anyway, it's a really interesting book. It's definitely worth reading. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.
Make sure you subscribe,
rate, review, all that stuff. And we'll see you again on Monday
morning, and see you again next week. And make sure you get if you are watching this, listening to this, make sure you do the Substack so you can see some embarrassing pictures of Spencer Ackerman.
That's right.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks,
now
guys. Bye. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.